Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Well, happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day, everyone. So a little bit rushed here in terms of getting out the announcements this morning, but it's happening. So, Greg, why don't you tell us what we have on tap?
All right, we have a great set of questions on respect without agreement, political correctness, responsibility for stolen firearms, and more.
Yeah, it's gonna be a good show. Okay, let's see, reminders here. If you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
All right, what's been going on this week?
I've been busy working. I've been busy doing Krav Maga. I did four classes, including a CrossFit style. They do a fitness class that's a CrossFit style hour long Metcon beatdown. And you know, I swore to myself when I started doing Super Slow that I would never ever again have to do another burpee. And apparently that's not true.
So, burpees are awesome.
I know.
Boy, that sucks kind of way. Yep.
Yeah, I'm better at them than I used to be. And it's been fun. It's been a really good time. And so look forward to packing on some more fitness and packing on some more skills and all of that too. So hooray.
Excellent.
Hooray. Yeah. So that's all I have. I think we should go ahead and get started with everything.
Alrighty. Respect without agreement. How can I help my father understand that I respect him even when I disagree with him? I generally value experience for its ability to provide helpful. I value experience for its ability to provide helpful insights, but I am suspicious of people who fall back on appeals to authority in an attempt to win arguments. My father often does that during our debates on various subjects, as we do not see eye to eye on many important issues. When I reject his appeals on the grounds that they are logically fallacious, he takes personal offense and accuses me of disrespecting him. I respect my father, and I try to convey my appreciation for his experience in other ways, but I want to have civil discourse with him that doesn't dead-end in this uncomfortable way someday. My father and I have been estranged for the last 5 years, in large part due to his tendency toward communicating in this and other manipulative ways, and my current attempt at reconciliation is failing again because of these communication issues. This is a shame because I truly feel that the makings of a good father-daughter relationship are in place, but my father cannot seem to stop predicating our ability to love and respect each other on my willingness to constantly agree with him simply because he's my father. What advice can you give on how best to halt this unhealthy pattern so that I can save my relationship with my dad?
This is a good question. This is a hard question. And this question is framed how careful it is, how much there's this real attempt to, hey, like I really want to make this work in the question. I would assume that you've already done the fairly obvious things, like that you kindly explained to your father why you can't accept his views on his say-so, that you show your appreciation and respect for him in other ways, ways that he actually deserves, that, you know, this has not been, you know, you've had a couple screaming matches and now you're sending me this question. No, it sounds like you've done all the reasonable things. And in that case, and if you haven't, by all means, go do all the reasonable things. But if you have, I don't think that you can do anything to fix this problem. And that's because this is your father's problem. This is a big problem on the part of your father. And you can't make him do better, right? You can't force a mind to think. You can't force a person to recognize the facts. You can't force a person to treat other people decently or to act consistently or to act on rational principles. And, your comment based on his other manipulative ways here, it sounds like this is not an isolated problem. And I actually have some more background from this person in the form of another question that does indicate, yeah, this is part of a serious, big pattern of irrationality and poor treatment on the part of the father. So, like, I sometimes you really have to say, look, I can't change this person as much as I want to, and as obvious as the facts are, and say I need to do something. I need to do something else here because that strategy has not worked. It's not working.
Yeah. So, what would be the something else that she might be able to do?
Yeah. So I like the positive discipline strategy here of decide what you will do. Right now, you cannot decide to change your father. Right, that's not in your realm of control. You can decide, though, to preserve your independence and your sanity in whatever relationship you have with him. And in particular, there's sort of two strategies that you can employ. Two things that you should think about here. One is you might try just as a intermediate step. You know, hey, maybe this will work, and maybe you've already done this. You can try to avoid problematic topics. Like maybe it's on political topics that he gets this way. And so you can say, look, Dad, I'm just not going to talk about politics with you anymore. Or you simply try to avoid you redirect the conversations, you try to avoid them. The problem with talking with him about it directly is that might make things much worse. It might backfire. Basically, the idea here is to set some boundaries, try to compartmentalize the relationship somewhat. That might work. That might enable you to have a good relationship on certain topics and then just not connect at all on others. So that's certainly one option. The other thing is I think you need to check yourself and make sure that you're not operating on some kind of implicit biblical duty to honor thy parents. Your father's behavior here, it's really, really wrong. And it's a barrier to any kind of substantive father-daughter relationship. It's a barrier to a relationship of mutual respect and trust, which is what you have to have with your adult parents. You cannot continue to have this relationship of parent-child, not even that I think parent-child should be as subservient in the way that he wants you to be, but you really need to have this mutual respect if you're going to have a good relationship with your parents as adults. And you can't have any kind of relationship with people that's predicated on you don't respect me unless you agree with me. That is just flatly in contradicting the virtue of independence and the virtue of rationality, and I'm sure in other ways every other single virtue. So you can't have a good relationship that's predicated on your acting in a vicious way. That's just not going to work. And so what you might need to do here ultimately is to lower your hopes and lower your expectations for a relationship with your father. You might need to have minimal contact, or at least less contact, or minimal contact, or even no contact at all. You don't have a duty to have a relationship with your father. You don't have an obligation to, and I hope that he brings other things to the table. It sounds like he does, and if you can find a way to salvage that part of the relationship, that's all well and good, but you certainly should not be compromising on your independence in a relationship with him. And I will also say, I think sometimes it can feel really just unfathomable, horrible, and impossible to cut ties with parents. And reasonably so. These are the people that raised you. This is a real problem. And in that case, I would really recommend therapy as a way to figure out what you want to do and work through those problems, because that can be really helpful. There's only so much that philosophy can do here.
No, that covers basically what we were thinking. It's just sad because I you can see this pattern with some people, and it's usually a lot more delimited sounding than it is in this case, where they will give advice, say, in a way that is basically an order. You know, it's like they expect you to do what they're saying, but they're. And it hurts their feelings terribly if you have to then push back and say, that's not really a good idea for me for the following reasons, or I'm not going to do it for the following reasons.
Yeah, and they'll often push you, and like they want to know that you're doing it. They're checking on you, and you're like, dude, great, now I have to tell you that I'm not.
It's like you're not my boss here. You're not managing my life. It's my life. And so it's really uncomfortable. You're put in a really uncomfortable position because – you wouldn't have to tell them, I'm not going to do what you're thinking, if they just offered it as an idea, say, rather than requiring your agreeing with and following their prescription, basically.
Right.
And it sounds like she's being stuck repeatedly in this circumstance and across many topics, not just
well, but it's not one, just that he's going to get his feelings hurt either, right?
He's going to infer
that she doesn't respect him. That's what I think is really, really...
You don't respect and love me if you don't obey me. And it's like,
right. Okay,
you wouldn't feel unloved if you didn't order me around with dumb orders. Sometimes if they're brilliant orders, I'll do it, of course. But then, you know, that still is assuming basic independence. Yeah. It's not because you ordered it. So it's just a shame. This is a terrible pattern that seems to be in the father's mind. And, boy, don't know. Yeah, it's back to the positive discipline idea. I can't tell him what he's going to do, but I can say what I'm going to do.
Right. Setting some boundaries seems. I mean, you could set, when people are like this, when people are, they have serious, uncalibrated behavior, you can set your boundaries, and sometimes that's unacceptable to them, and you have to be okay with that. That's sometimes where, particularly with parent-child relationship therapy, might be a really good idea. You can, you can say, look, like, this is what I'm willing to do, and I'm not willing to do anymore, or I can't. And this is as much as I'm willing to do. And they might go ballistic. They might have a fit. And in a way, you have to be okay with that, because that's on them. That's not you forcing them to behave that way. That's them choosing to react in that way.
Yeah. All right. It's a bit to think about. What's the take-home point?
Take-home point: you cannot reasonably expect to change your father, but you can decide what you will do, and that might even include cutting off the relationship or at least reducing it in some fashion.
All right. Don't see Kip Young. It's kind of a downer first topic for Father's Day. Yeah, I'm not really
I didn't choose that with Father's Day in mind, sorry.
Yeah. All right. So reminder about the tip jar, please.
Oh, yes. So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Voila, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content. And we on the other side really appreciate that regular support. And again, you can do all that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Political correctness. What is the value of political correctness? I used to be a fairly typical right-winger who would regularly cry out, political correctness has gone mad, politically correct ideas that I find ridiculous. For example, the Ban Bossy campaign. I'm finding myself more sympathetic to these ideas as I become more informed on them. So I'm now in favor of using the right pronouns for transgender people, avoiding words that can be perceived as derogatory, for example, fag, and even changing school event names like Parent Day or Christmas Party to something that doesn't exclude those it doesn't apply to. Where should the line be drawn between political correctness and making valuable changes in our language or practices to be more accommodating and inclusive of people outside the mainstream? Are there legitimate concerns about language becoming more politically correct?
Yes and no. Basically, the whole concept of political correctness is just meaningless junk. And to me, when you and I were talking about it, it seemed like there was two sort of different phenomena that ended up being lumped together under this concept of political correctness.
Yeah.
It's a package.
It's very different
deal.
Things. It's
yeah.
a crappy concept.
Yeah. So sometimes, and we see this particularly from the left, there's manipulations and bullying, particularly about the use of language in order to advance their political agenda. So one of the things that I see is like this just hostility and shaming of people who choose not to recycle. Like, you can't have a reasonable discussion about this. You can't talk about the economics of this. And these are people who have no idea about the economics of recycling, right? They do it because it makes them feel like they're doing their part for the earth while they drink, one bottle of water after another. And so there is this, like, I don't know, it's there is that kind of shaming that goes on in the left. You also have things like the language change from global warming to climate change, right? So now anything, any weird weather qualifies as climate change.
First it was global warming, then climate change. Now it's climate disruption, and the ever-changing set of terms kind of keep you off balance.
Yeah, and I would actually include the changing of racial terms, particularly the changing of the now that it's not, we're no longer allowed to refer to people as black, allowed, right? I still do, and some people still do. African-American is the new term. But that makes it about something more substantial than skin color, which is actually a problem, right? So there's a substantive change underneath that. So KPOM started off this question with a comment, this topic needs a trigger warning, and that's something that's exactly of that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you should, you know, if you're going to write about rape or incest or, you know, abuse of various kinds, let people know up front. Like, this is just, like, it's just a polite thing to do.
Yeah.
To tell them,
like, using some strong language here.
Yeah,
so,
like, not safe for work, right? Like, these are, you know, that's a kind of polite thing to do. But this whole trigger warning that you're, like, obliged to do it, and, like, you can't, you know, professors can't teach philosophy classes because if we, like, we might have a conversation about rape or sexual assault, and there might be opinions expressed in class that certain people find completely unacceptable, and they just can't, like, they just literally can't even, and, you know, therefore then it, you know, gets reported to the dean, and the professor gets in trouble, and blah, 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 right? Like, that's the kind of thing that is highly, highly wrong and highly unacceptable. But that is not, like, to call that political correctness is not the issue. That's not the problem. The problem is bullying and manipulation and people being special snowflakes in that particular case. So the other thing that gets lumped under political correctness, and this is where I think the concept really, really goes awry. Like, if we're thinking about these manipulations of bullying, political correctness just doesn't seem strong enough. That's not capturing what's going on in this case. But then what we have more commonly, what gets called political correctness, are attempts to be kind and tolerant and sensitive and inclusive to the people around us, particularly people who are outside the mainstream. So it's basically the thought of, hey, let's make sure that everybody feels welcome. And that gets labeled as political correctness, as if that's part of some kind of nefarious agenda in the way that trigger warnings are, right?
Yeah. So on the one hand, they take something that's a very reasonable thing, being reasonable, considerate, and tolerant, and they give it a whole new label when we already have words for that called consideration,
right,
things like that.
Yep.
And it gets teamed up with this social thuggery, this social bullying, and it's a horrible stew. Yeah.
Yeah. These you know, this is a package deal concept. You're packaging things together that are fundamentally different. I think it's in order to condemn these attempts to be kind and tolerant and sensitive and inclusive, as if they were the same as trigger warnings and, you know, crazy leftist feminists going hysterical, right? No. And so examples of this would include banning peanuts in school with young kids because some kids are super, super life-threateningly allergic, right? Or wishing people happy holidays rather than Merry Christmas. And somehow this is supposed to be a war on Christmas. Are you freaking kidding me? It's just that not everybody celebrates Christmas. And Greg, you actually have a thing you do about that I really like.
I also recognize the culture I'm in. This is a generally Christian culture. It's Christmas is generally that holiday, and it's just for me, it's a matter of politeness. I default to just saying Merry Christmas to people, and if I happen to know somebody is really not a Christian, I'll switch my default to Happy Holidays. Or if I'm in a really mixed crowd, it's like, well, yeah, Happy Holidays. But I really don't get too stressed about it, except with the hardcore war on Christmas evangelical types, where I will specifically say Happy Holidays to them.
Yeah.
Not. Yeah. Because I think what they're doing is goofy, and they're getting into the stupid politically correct bullying kind of things.
Yes.
So I don't like the manipulations and the lack of consideration for others.
You know, and I was in a conversation. I mean, I'm used to amongst my philosophy crowd.
I have to say, I don't seek to be offensive to people. It's targeted. It's like I try never to offend people by accident.
Yes.
In this case, it's they deserve it.
You're a guy who kind of likes to tweak people on occasion. You know?
Yeah. You've earned it.
If they've earned it. So another example. So I mean the prelude here. So amongst my philosophy crowd, my objections friends, like I'm friends with a lot of particularly gay men. I mean they're just like they're everywhere, right? Amongst my objectivist friends. And so to me, like that is just very normal. Gay relationships are just like they're just part of my landscape. And in fact they're a disproportionately large part of my landscape in terms of my friendships. And so I was out with some horse people and one of the gals who I really like nice person, I'm sure treats everybody with a reasonable amount of respect, was complaining, I think it was she was complaining about the show Arrow. And how there was like they had to have a gay relationship in that. Like and her what she said actually was, why can't they just have normal relationships? And I was just like, wow, like this still exists, this view, right? But I think that one of the things that is important is by including gay relationships in television, you are treating them as normal. They're just part of the landscape that happens now. In Arrow, not that anything is normal about that universe. Mm. So, normal is relative. But actually, it was one of those cases where I know I should have said something, but I was just so floored that I couldn't get anything out in time. But that's the kind of thing. Like the more that these are out there and just part of the landscape, the more tolerant and inclusive, and you know, oh, no big deal. People will be about. Non-traditional things. And I will say, like, these kinds of things, like peanut bands and having, you know, showing gay relationships on television and wishing people happy holidays and calling Caitlyn Jenner she, these are not some kind of nefarious plot to destroy the civilization and the family and everything that is good and masculine in this universe.
Sorry, all the things, yes.
Yeah. The fact is, and this has always been true, not everyone is conventional. Not everyone is like the majority. And it's really, really great. It's really great to live in a culture that welcomes differences on these kinds of morally optional matters rather than forcing people into closets. Because closets suck for everybody. Right? You don't want to be in a gay closet. You don't want to be in an atheist closet. You don't want to be in a polyamorous closet. You don't want to be in, like, you know, you don't have to be trying to pass for white. Whatever it is, you do not want to be. You don't want to be hiding who you actually are. And I think that this is actually one of the major, major problems with Republicans and conservatives and so on, is that they often, there's this belligerent attempt to appeal only to white Christians, as if everyone else doesn't matter, as if everyone else that's outside that mainstream just needs to either, like, change or shut up. Like, they are not welcome. And I see this particularly, it's floored me at Republican events, like, you know, not necessarily Republican Party events, I don't think, but groups that were explicitly, like, to support the Republican Party kind of thing. When there were opening prayers or closing prayers, which, like, granted, I get most people are religious, even though I'm an atheist, that's okay, I can tolerate that. But prayers in Jesus' name. And I was just like, wow, that's what you're going to do. It's not just that you're going to say atheists are not welcome, but pretty much you're saying only Christians here. The fact is that America is a much, much more diverse place since the founding era, with lots of changes in language and cultural norms and so on, and there are lots more room for differences. Like, there's room for women in pants, right? And we should all be really grateful for that. We all don't have to fit into the same mold. We can all find our own path. We can all find our own people, you know, without fear of being strung up on a nearby tree. This is really, really important, or socially ostracized, right?
I think it's good to emphasize that we live in a fantastic nation where we're free. We're free to be different than the next guy, and I really like a culture that goes along with it, where we say, oh, yeah, pantsuits. I would never wear one, but, you know, more power to you.
Yeah, yeah. I do think there's this attitude underneath these kinds of complaints about political correctness. There's this attitude of entitlement, which is funny because it's coming from the right, and you normally expect this kind of charge to be made against people on the left. But there is this attitude of entitlement, which is, I'm entitled for the world to be exactly what I'm used to. I'm entitled for the majority to be catered to. I'm entitled to have other people conform to me. And it's a kind of divine right of stagnation. And I think that this is often what the charge of political correctness means. And I think that if you're somebody who tends to think in terms of political correctness, A, think about what a junk concept this is to begin with, but also beware of that in yourself. Beware of attempting essentially to bully and manipulate people into hiding who they are if that's not mainstream. And it's in a way, it's exactly what the left does here. It's just the right's attempt to do it, and it's less smart, it's less savvy than the way the left does it. But it's still that kind of thing. And that's really inappropriate. Like, A, live and let live a little bit more, and B, like, don't be a dick.
So, and as far as the one tip I would give is, you can improve your own mind, your own thinking, by just stopping yourself anytime you find yourself using or hearing the term political correctness, and ask, which concept am I really talking about? Why don't I use that one?
Right.
Am I talking about someone being impolite, tactless, non-inclusive, non-tolerant? Let's just call that what it is. You're being an impolite asshole, so why not lighten up? Or be a little more inclusive, because it's not your life, it's their life. Or are you talking about somebody who's manipulating and bullying? If that's the case, call it that.
Right.
That's manipulative. Why don't you lay off?
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't have to recycle. If you want to sort garbage, go ahead and sort garbage. I don't want to sort garbage.
Yeah, I think this is always true. When you have these kinds of vague terms that don't have a really clear meaning, at the very least, even if you haven't decided that the term is junk yet, but while you're going, I don't like this term. I don't know quite what it means. It's not, it feels like it's uniting weird things together. Set aside that term, don't use it, and be more specific. It's always good. I mean, think about your eighth grade writing teacher who was like, don't tell, show, right? So be more specific, be more concrete in the way you're describing things, and that will be more accurate.
Yeah. And we noticed that in the prep meetings. Like, I tend not to think in terms of political correctness, and I didn't really analyze it that much before. It's probably because it's just a junky term, and it.
Right.
Yeah, it's a nice one to weed out. I'm going to weed it out consciously now.
I don't think I've said the term in the last decade, but
now
I really wouldn't.
But now I'll be like my buddies and my friends around me, when they use it, I'm going to be like, hey, which do you mean, this or that? Let's just talk about those. All right. So what about other problems with the use of language and culture in political debates?
Yeah, I mean, there are really, really big problems here, right? I think there's manipulation, there's confusion on both sides. I think there's more manipulation on the left and confusion on the right. I think the left is just more savvy than the right is. That's my impression. But again, this concept of political correctness, it just muddies the water further. If you actually want an example of a really useful way of looking at the use of language, the use of sophistry, basically, I'd recommend Slate Star Codex's discussion of, I think it's pronounced Moton Bailey. Basically, it's a way of analyzing how people tend to argue, and the way that they're, particularly on the left, although this happens on the right too, they're fundamentally dishonest about what they're arguing for. And that's really useful. That's really clarifying. And what's really great about it is that it's ideologically neutral. You can see your enemies doing this, and you can see your allies doing it. And so that's the kind of thing that I think we need more of, that kind of awareness of how political debates are unfolding. Not in this, I'm gonna hit you back with some kind of new partisan phrase. No, like let's take a step back and look at how everything's going wrong.
Indeed. All right. A lot of nice material. What's the take-home point?
Take-home point. The whole concept of political correctness is meaningless junk that deserves to be scrapped. Language is badly abused in our cultural and political debates, but that needs to be addressed in nonpartisan ways.
Excellent. All right. Not much in the way of follow-up. So why don't you remind listeners about your premium content on finding good prospects for romance and friendship?
Yeah, so this is a 90-minute podcast that discusses how to make yourself a good prospect and how to find good prospects for romance and friendship. You can preview over 30 minutes of the podcast over at philosophyinaction.com/romancecast. Then you can purchase the access to the full 90-minute version for just $10. Also, if you're a regular contributor to Philosophy in Action's tip jar, it's free to use. So just email me for your access. Again, that's over at philosophyinaction.com/romancecast.
Responsibility for stolen firearms. Should a person injured by a stolen gun be permitted to sue the original owner thereof for damages? Imagine that a person's firearm is stolen, then used in a crime to injure an innocent person. Can the crime victim sue the owner of the gun for damages? Would it matter if the gun was left in plain sight or not locked away? Would it matter if the gun was stolen or months or years before the crime? Also, what if the gun owner lent his gun to another person who he reasonably thought was honest and law-abiding? If the gun owner is not legally liable, might he be morally culpable?
So one of the things that happened in our production meeting was Tammy, we had gotten into it a little bit. She quipped at some point, go after the gun manufacturers, they have deeper pockets. Which, like, that was very funny. But the problem is this is exactly what too many people think, particularly too many lawyers. If something gone wrong, somebody's been hurt, sue everyone and everything in sight.
Yeah, go looking for the deep pockets. Her tongue was in her cheek very
yes.
firmly.
Oh, very obviously. Yeah. I mean, that whole strategy, that's super unjust, super immoral. The critical moral question, like let's say if you have been injured in a crime and there's some question about filing a lawsuit or whatever it is, and in fact, this is before any lawsuit, you have to ask yourself, who was actually in the wrong here? Who was actually negligent or intentionally?
Is there some responsibility?
Anyone, yeah. Don't just start spraying legal bullets. That's no better than what they just did.
Yeah.
So with respect to criminal gaining access to a firearm, it's possible to imagine scenarios where the owner was negligent in contrast to scenarios where the owner took all proper care. So imagine that the gun was stored inside the home. Perhaps it was locked away or at least out of sight. And the criminal invades and steals the gun, and then he takes that and uses that to commit the crime. Here, there's no negligence on the part of the owner. The owner secured his property, so all the responsibility would fall on the criminal. Now, imagine, on the other hand, somebody else leaves a weapon outside, like sitting on a table right next to the front gate. It's in plain sight. It could be seen and grabbed by anyone, including small children who are passing by. Or maybe somebody lent it to a friend with a history of bank robberies, right? Then you've got a good case for negligence. The person, the gun owner, failed to exercise due care with dangerous property, and harm was done to an innocent crime victim as a result. Now, the criminal is still responsible for the crime. He doesn't get less of a sentence, not a mitigating factor, because he stole from his weapon.
Just because I did something wrong doesn't mean you didn't.
Yeah, but it might be that particularly as far as tort law is concerned, as far as the tort is concerned, that the gun owner is partly responsible for damages. And so that's sort of the question is basically, were you negligent? And Greg, you had a comment here about.
Yeah, it was just a context setter because that could condition how you react to some of this. You can ask, does someone stealing the gun from your car, for example, give them access to weaponry that they couldn't get from other sources? So did you actually enable this?
Right.
Because if everybody's got a gun in the neighborhood, it doesn't make any difference if yours was loaned to somebody. But if they're very rare and it's being and it was a huge enabling factor, it's like, okay, that's different.
Yeah, and this gets to the question of proximate causation. And I was actually going to say something about the law's views about for negligence, you need proximate causation and you need foreseeability. And there's I have lots of interesting stuff on this in my book, Responsibility and Luck, which if you're interested in this, I definitely recommend you pick up. But the problem is, the reason I actually decided I didn't end up writing any notes on this was because this case deals with the super-duper complicated factor about divvying up responsibility between two people. And I was just like, oh, shit. Like, on the one hand, I've I've read tons and tons about this on tort law and assigning responsibility and so on, but I didn't care at all about responsibility shared between two people. And so I would just ignore all of those sections. So I can't really speak to that. But if you're just generally interested in issues about proximate causation and foreseeability and how that works in the law and how that generally works with cases of moral responsibility, then by all means go check out my book, Responsibility and Block. Now, I will say, I do think you can apply the control and epistemic conditions for moral responsibility that I did develop in my book. So you can look at the control condition and you can say, look, if the gun owner was negligent, that what that means is that he had control over the weapon, and then he willfully ceded control to the criminal by his own failure to take reasonable care. And then it also satisfies the epistemic condition if he's negligent. The gun owner knew or should have known that his carelessness about the gun could result in criminal or accidental harm to others. So, that's what we see in these kind of cases. Now, I will say there's nothing unique about firearms here. There's no special rules just for guns, right? This is just a very common item in the broader class of dangerous property that might be stolen.
Yeah, you could do the same with paint and cars. And I like it that way. We should use general principles like this.
Right. And because of that, I actually think it might matter. It might matter when the gun was stolen, right? It's the longer that it's in the possession of somebody other than the owner, the less that the owner can be said to be the proximate cause of any harm done. But again, whatever rules you have for firearms, you should also have for gasoline, for example.
Yeah. And that's, that goes back to the availability. I mean, how much did you really help if the gun was stolen from you and used a year later? It's like, well, hey, if you really wanted a gun during that year, you could have had it 1,000 different ways.
Right.
So not a lot of responsibility on this person's part.
Right.
Okay, so does a person have an obligation to report a firearm stolen?
I think except in really rare cases, there's no obligation to report any crime, no legal obligation. It might be morally the right thing to do in plenty of cases, but there's no legal obligation. I think that's just a matter of your liberty rights, your free speech rights. You don't have to report the crime. I do, however, think it's obviously in a person's interest to report if their firearm has been stolen so that they are not confused with the criminal. Right? That seems fairly obvious.
And how about lending a firearm?
Yeah, I have no problem with lending firearms. This is something that was actually recently forbidden by Colorado law, which sucks. And, the basic principle here, again, though, is don't be negligent. Don't lend to a known or suspected criminal. Don't lend to a stranger. I mean, that's legally dumb on your part.
Someone comes, your friend, who isn't a criminal, not insane, comes in very worked up and pissed off. Hey, I need to borrow your gun. Maybe that would be negligent. You don't want
to give it. Yeah, that's not the best idea, right? But I've done this before. Like, a friend wanted to test out a certain gun that I owned for concealed carry purposes, and they had a concealed carry license, and I was able to say, sure, by all means, borrow it for a week and see if you like how it feels when you carry it. And, there was absolutely nothing negligent about that.
Yeah, awkward conversation. Yeah, I see you have a license, but you're still kind of sketch. I'm not giving you my gun. Sorry, we're not that close. All right. When might a person be morally but not legally culpable, because they made the distinction in the question, for harm done by a stolen firearm?
Yeah, so I think that in some cases the owner might be negligent, but the courts are unable to prove that. There's always epistemic problems here. And also, people do really, really crazy things. Crazy, crazy things. And the law might not be sufficiently fine-grained to deal with certain kinds of crazy cases. Or the law just might be badly written or something like that. But the kinds of – I mean, this is one of the things that makes reading legal cases fun, is that you just realize, like, how the heck did that happen? Like, come on, people. What the hell? Right? So like, people do crazy stuff, and so the law might not always be able to predict in advance the level of crazy to which people – particularly criminals, will think.
People are awesome random action machines that can never ending bags of surprise.
Well, particularly criminals, right? Yeah.
That's where way back when there used to be a show called Cops or something like that. Bad Boys, that one. And two real patterns. One, nobody wears shirts in the tray. I don't get that. And two, random stuff happening all the time. It's just nutty.
Yeah.
So with you on the nuttiness. Okay. What's the take-home point?
So a gun owner might be liable for harms inflicted on innocent parties by his weapon if he was negligent with that weapon in some fashion, just as he would be with other kinds of dangerous weapons.
Yeah. All right, a little bit of follow-up here. KPOM asks, what was the result of the Aurora shooting, referring to the ban on lending guns?
Yeah, was that the result of the Aurora shooting? Yes, there was actually a bunch of anti-gun, there was a bunch of anti-gun legislation that was passed, including limits on magazines and all kinds of other, a bunch of really, really bad, stupid, stupid, ridiculous, bad things. And so, yeah, this was actually one of the reasons why the Republicans did better in the most recent election, despite their crazy anti-abortion views.
All right. Well, nothing else. We can move on. It's rapid-fire question time, and we've got 20 minutes, 19 minutes, to go to town on these. I'll put Diana on the hot seat with these questions drawn from a long and growing queue in any old order I like. She didn't do a lot of prep. Could get interesting. Let's see. Oh, that's topical right up front. Hey, was Rachel Dolezal? I can't.
Dolezal? I have no idea how to pronounce that.
I've heard it okay. Several times, but I gave up trying to store it because I didn't care about her. Was she wrong for lying about her race in order to fight against racism for the NAACP? You see, that's not politically correct. The CP stands for colored person, and I know that was upgraded to black, and that was upgraded to African American. They should fix that.
Yeah.
They aren't being politically correct.
I know.
Anyway, so, what's your reaction to this woman who has been painting herself as black all this time?
Not literally, but so.
Well, actually, apparently she did some makeup and hair work.
So first of all, I think that there's just a straightforward case of fraud and lying and deception on her part. So that's super simple, right? There's probably some, I don't know, like they would rise to the level of mental illness, but like mental struggles and, from headlines I've read, and I haven't followed the case really closely, it sounds like there might have been serious problems in her upbringing and other kinds of things that she would have issues with. So there's that. On the other hand, I think it's, and I also think that the attempt to make a comparison between her and Caitlyn Jenner is ridiculous. The sex is something, and one's experience of sex is substantially biological. This is contrary to what conservatives and some objectivists say. One cannot simply look down to one's genitalia and go, look, I've got a penis, therefore I'm a man, or look, no penis, therefore I'm a woman. It doesn't work that way. That sex is substantially about hormones, and those may or may not match your external genitalia. And this is obviously proven. This is obviously proven by the fact that if you woke up tomorrow as the opposite sex from what you are right now, you would not go, oh, well, all right then. I guess I'm a man. I guess I'm a woman. Like, end of story, right?
And you would be like, find me some meat. And it's like, I think I would still like girls.
It's not that. It's not about sexual orientation. No, it's about you would feel like, you'd still feel like a man, right? That's my point. Sexual orientation is completely orthogonal.
Oh, sorry. I hopped topics on you, didn't I?
Yeah,
I would probably feel like, well, okay, I got dropped into another body.
Yeah. And,
or
and
somebody, I mean, somebody modified, did some body mods on me, and they didn't change what I actually am. They just changed something superficial.
Yeah, and you might, like, granted, I would not wish to change back immediately. There's some sexual experimentation I would really wish to do if I were a man for, a while. But then I'd be like, okay, it's time, time to get back to being a woman.
Okay, that was a weird share.
It's not like I'd be, oh God, no, I can't be a man. Like, no, I'm like, I'll be a man for a few weeks and see what this is like. Sure. But like, I would really want to go back to being a woman.
I suppose there's some classic movie plots in there somewhere.
Good sci-fi. So good, well, either bad porn or good sci-fi, right? anyway, so I'm blushing now. I knew that would happen. Anyway, so you know, you can't just look down, right? You have a whole, I mean, A, you've got hormonal issues, and you've also got character and personality issues that are built up around your being one sex or the other. And this is why you can, like, this view about how your sex is determined that we see from conservative sides is so completely bizarre to me. But race is not like that. Race is, there's no biology to being, there's no sort of like deep biological brain hormone chemistry stuff to being black versus white versus Asian. There is cultural identification. And I think that certainly a person can identify more, can identify with a culture that is not of their outward form. And I think that in a way that was what this gal was trying to do, but unfortunately in a very dishonest and, very, very dishonest kind of way. So Trey says, and I think this is right, he says, I actually think the confusion is the lack of a distinction here. We have sex and gender, and those are separate concepts. Yes, so sex would be your biological outward form. Gender is your experience of, whether you feel like a man or a woman, what you identify with. And he says, with race, we don't have the ability to distinguish with a single word between the biology and the culture and cultural experience. And this is a real problem in the way that our language functions. And in general, that morally, we haven't clearly separated out these things.
Yeah, nicely put, Trey. Yeah, what a mess. But I do. It is somewhat humorous to see the right using the tools of the left on the left to tweak them with. You guys, you like to make lots of other things fluid and socially determined, and why not this too?
Yeah, I mean, except
it's amusing.
Yeah, particularly the left really, like, part of the problem with the left is that they really want to pair one's biological race with one's cultural identification, like ethnic.
Yeah, ethnic actually so, like, blurs them in a gross way.
Like,
yeah.
the left is the one who basically treats people like race traitors in various ways, shapes, and forms, and that's part of what disgusts me about all the rhetoric. I don't know, the whole rhetoric about this is all...
Yeah, well, you can see the bullying and thuggery and the you're not a genuine woman, you're not a genuine black man or whatever.
Right.
What a mess. I was so distracted by that discussion, I didn't even look ahead to find the next one just to hit you with, so...
One down, all right.
Oh, yeah, that actually is a good one, yeah. Given our declining freedoms in the U.S., have you ever thought about moving out of the country? Would you be willing to leave if greater freedoms existed elsewhere?
My answer is no and yes. They would have to be substantially greater freedoms. I like American culture. I mean, not all aspects of it, but there's a lot that I like about American culture. I like how big America is. I like our landscape and our scenery. I like that all of my friends are here and my family is here. Like, that really matters to me. The thought of... you know, particularly moving across the world and never seeing some people that I love and care for again, or not seeing them except on rare occasion, that would really suck. I reject the premise of our declining freedoms here in the United States. Like, we're not like sinking into dictatorship. So.
Slightly different answer here. Mine is yes and yes. Yes, I've thought about it, and yes, I would. And the reason nothing's happened is because it's not even close yet. Not even close to a sufficient differential for me to go see ya. It's just no other place is markedly better.
Right.
Just not the case. This is a really great country, despite all of its troubles.
Yeah.
So yeah, what a mess. Hey, in the current climate of police distrust and rampant abuses of power, would you advise against filming a police encounter that appeared to be suspicious or violent?
No, I would recommend that you do film a police encounter. I mean,
not bad.
You might not wish to persist if the police belligerently tells you to put down your camera, right? But but I do really advise filming. I think that's been hugely important that that's happened. I think the more that that happens, the better. And what I really want to see is universal body cameras. And that basically in any encounter, if there's no video recording, that would be an assumption, particularly if, oh, like we lost her, right? That would be an assumption of wrongdoing. That would be evidence of wrongdoing. Because that's their obligation is to be transparent. And I mean, I will say, look, there's a lot of really good cops out there. I certainly know my share, and they have a really hard job of dealing with the low lives of humanity, right? And protecting all the rest of us, protecting decent folks from those low lives. But there's also some really, really bad apples, and there's a attitude of protect our own, which happens in so many professions. It happens in the medical profession too. And that needs to stop. That needs to change.
Yeah.
So Trey just posted a isn't it that hyperbole and a half image? A film of the police encounters. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I love that we're living in the era of smartphones with cameras, that everybody has one in their pocket. If something's going down, they can just whip it out and start filming.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty close to cameras on every cop's body. They have a way of losing films that are inconvenient sometimes.
Yeah, like. I don't think we get nearly enough. I think it's been I think we need to have those dash cams. I think those are protected to police too. Those are protected to police who are doing their job, and I think that's really important.
And they're really cheap now. You could have a four-way surround video on every cop car and every cop body.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So getting a little technical here. Somebody asks, when I read postmodern philosophy, it seems like philosophy is starting to melt into the social sciences. What do you think of this observation?
I think melt is just the right word. scramble might be another. So I took a class on philosophy as an undergrad. I took it only because my favorite professor, my mentor really, is as an undergrad, was teaching it. And so I knew it would essentially be taught with the clarity of an analytic philosophy class. It was horrible. It was truly the worst thing. I mean, there's just no making sense of Derrida. Derrida does not wish to be made sense of. And not to say that there's not some interesting things, ideas swimming around in there. I mean, existentialism is always fairly interesting, but that's too early in the postmodern trajectory. Too comprehensible. Foucault is actually, I always found him fairly interesting. But yes, there is this like this interplay with the social sciences, which is odd. And that I don't think is terrible in the sense that one of the things that I really dislike about the analytic philosophy tradition is how much it's isolated itself from the rest of the humanities and from the sciences as well, but more from the humanities. And so like I like philosophy that's talking to other disciplines, that has let's talk about these things, these intersection areas, let's work on them together, let's learn from them, and so on. And not that the postmodernists are like, not that that's really their approach, but there's a reason why postmodern philosophy has been widely adopted, or you see more of that in other humanities. It's a negligible influence in philosophy departments, but it's much more influential in, you know, literature and history and other areas. And that's because they have explicitly said, like, hey, look, let's talk about this, people. Like, let's make this interdisciplinary. And as a strategy, that has actually worked.
Nice. Okay, this one found a nice little pocket of questions here. What are some of the moral concerns with commissioning art? And I can sense two senses of this already that you probably want to talk about.
Moral concerns with commissioning art. What? Like,
yeah, so
pay your bills and don't ask for anything ridiculous? Like, yeah, I don't understand what the moral concerns would be.
Well, okay, so not just personally commissioning art, but perhaps politically, like having a government commissioning art.
Oh, that would
maybe
be.
Maybe that's what they're going for, yeah.
I have no idea.
So I think the moral concern is no, don't ever. No government commissioning of art. That's
right.
Something that's needed.
Well,
that would save you from all those problems.
I mean, if there's a courthouse, you know, like they could have a statue of justice out there. I'd be okay with that. You know, like I don't think government buildings in a free society would have to be completely ugly and disgusting and not have any aesthetic features on them whatsoever.
Oh, okay. So then what sort of guidelines would you give for lining up that kind of art or allowing people to place that kind of art?
I have no idea. You would hope it would be done with people with some kind of taste. I don't know. God. Like, that's like, of all the
very similar to having the architect in there, too. It's like, well, okay, how do you guide the architect? This is a...
Yeah.
We've got a board that votes on what to do, I guess.
Yeah, you want something that's like, a nice balance of attractive and functional and cost-effective. Right.
Yeah. So this probably goes in the category of... whoever owns the property gets to decide how it's used. And in the case of these collectively owned bits of property, the collective, we've got various mechanisms, commissions and whatever. The collective decides using those mechanisms. And if it doesn't work out, then it's crappy. And the next version gets built, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
you know,
dumb.
In Denver, we have some really awful, like really, really awful public art. And it's such a shame because there's so much really great Western art here, most of which you see in private businesses, you know, like statues with horses and cowboys and that kind of stuff that some private business will have. And sometimes it's amazing. You're like, wow, that's phenomenal. So, but at the airport, those of you who have flown into or out of PIA are familiar with our blue demon horse, who not only killed his creator, he fell on him and killed him.
Oh.
But he has red eyes that glow at night.
Oh.
And, like, he is a demon horse. He's really sort of scary. But I have to say, like, he's grown on me as, like, badass, like, don't F with us kind of horse.
Yeah, KPOM tosses in, should government architects push the envelope or just conform to current norms? Let's commission a study as to whether we should commission art.
Yeah.
So part of the study, let's commission two artists to provide examples for consideration.
wait, about the horse. He's the horse I will ride over the ruins of civilization when I'm done destroying it.
That's right. Trey has been in the background talking about how, what if I do want to destroy civilization?
Yeah. Trey and his gay agenda. You know?
Yeah, you and your gay agenda destroys civilization.
Yeah.
So Tammy and I have a little experience with this public art thing because we're downtownies. We live in this condo downtown. In our hood right here, they have public art on the street that they've been installing bits and pieces of here and there. And one is a constellation that's etched into the stone with various stars as little plates. And when you're way up high, you can pick up. You know, you can look down and see the stars and up to see the stars.
Oh,
Tammy's not happy with that because it's not lit, but I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Another one is by an architect who we actually considered for building our house because he's done cool stuff. His name's Dwayne. But this thing is horrid. They started installing this thing made of old pipes in our street. We're looking at it and going, what the hell? And they put the plaque on it. Now we think of it as Dwayne's eyesore because – someday it'll have vines growing all over it and supposedly be super cool, but it just looks dumb. And,
yeah.
And the whole time we're like, wow, somebody gave him a pile of money so they could put this eyesore on our streets.
We have one in Denver that's a bunch of like red intestines.
Mm.
It's gross. Yeah.
Not growing on you?
No, that one's not growing on me.
Okay. Finally, sometimes I hear people talk about the importance of feeling like a part of your community. Is this just collectivist nonsense? I've never felt like a part of a community.
No, it's not collectivist nonsense. I think it might depend on your personality as to how important this is to you. For me, this is actually something that's really, really important. And it's been both very satisfying and also has gotten me into all kinds of trouble at various points in my life. So, I mean, I think it's really important to pick your communities wisely. And it's important to pick the people in your community wisely, to pick your sort of sub-community in your community. And it's important to subjugate yourself intellectually or otherwise to people in your community, to be an independent individual nonetheless. But that can be really important. That can be really fulfilling and really meaningful to people to be part of that, to have that kind of social, that kind of social network. And so, no, not collectivist nonsense, or at least it doesn't have to be. It can be, but it doesn't.
Yeah. A lot of people do treat it as collectivist nonsense. They do subjugate themselves to the majority or the group or whatever. But a good human being could maintain their independence while still identifying with other good humans. I do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't.
There's my tribe. I like my tribe.
They don't choose their communities in the way that they ought to. So they just, like, they happen to have people that they went to college with or people that they do this or that activity with, and they don't think, like, are these the kinds of people that I really like? Are these the kinds of people who are going to make me better people? Are these the kind of people who are going to make me a better person or not? And I think that's really critical. You want your community to be people you can trust, people you can rely on, people who will inspire you, people who will ask the best of you, who will tell you when you've gone wrong. People should be really choosy about the communities that they choose as their own.
Yeah. That's why on occasion we see just really horrible behavior or trends, and we stop and go, yeah, maybe I don't think I want to have this label anymore. This is not good. These guys are being tarred heads, and I just don't want to be a part of that or associated with it in any way. So, yeah, choose your communities wisely.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I think we're good. It's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a great time. Thank you all to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Philosophy introduces thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and on what we could do better, too. Actually, Diana treasures the critical letters. Some of them are really over the top and awesome. She shares
them. If they're ridiculous, I post them to Facebook. But
Yeah. So go big.
Yeah.
Just send the feedback.
Go
big.
Yeah,
send it right to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.